Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to a brand new week on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and thank you for joining us. Hey, we've got some very good news about the show to share with you, but you have to wait until the end. And trust me, it's worth the anticipation.
Anticipation.
But first, let's get to the conversations. We begin today with some questions. Is your favorite toothpaste still available at your local drugstore? Have you been able to replace your kids' worn school shoes? Are you still stocking up on paper towels? In short, how's the supply chain treating you?
Hi, this is Dominic Reeve from Columbia, South Carolina. I've had a problem with shoes. I always had problems getting shoes wide enough to accommodate my feet and the orthotics I need. I recently went in search physically by phone and online and finally found what I hope will be a good fit. I was told at every turn that there were supply chain issues with shoes.
This is Kelly from Oviedo, Florida. I have pet ducks, and I've been surprised that dried mealworms have not been available due to the supply chain problem. And also, my dog uses eardrops on a daily basis to avoid infections due to allergies. The eardrops are unavailable currently with no end in sight.
I went to IKEA to get chairs for my new apartment, and when we got to the stock area, the entire aisle was empty. It almost felt like a ghost story. Oh, my name is Kevin, and I'm from New York City.
Now, it's pretty clear that many of you already know this, but just in case you haven't personally encountered it yet, the global supply chain is a bit of a mess. And the challenges this mess is causing has transformed local reporters into macroeconomics 101 professors on the evening news. Check out this helpful mini lecture from ABC affiliate WFAA in Texas.
Goods are made overseas, then loaded into shipping containers and put into cargo ships. Ships arrive at a port to dock. Workers and crews unload the huge containers of goods and prep them for transport via truck or train. The containers arrive at distribution centers for major retailers and shippers like Walmart and UPS. Then the goods get sent to their final destinations, like retail stores where you, the consumer, can buy them.
These days, the reality of our supply chain is not nearly this clear-cut.
Name a part, and it is at least partly broken.
This is Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic. He joined The Takeaway to help us understand the complex issues causing shortages on store shelves and slowdowns in services.
We can start with the container ships that we know are bobbing off the coast of Los Angeles and Long Beach in California. We have had many shots and photographs of those container ships that have created a traffic jam. That traffic jam is creating further traffic jams in the American interior because of the container ships, essentially, that can't be unloaded. You have trains that are backed up. Because of the trains being backed up, you also have truckers that can't fulfill their duties. You have a 60,000 person trucker shortage in the United States. This is a long ongoing shortage that has slammed up against the reality of the pandemic. And then finally, you have an overall labor shortage in the US for a variety of reasons. So just about everywhere you look in the supply chain, from the international container ships to the domestic rail, to the American truckers, to the people who put the stuff on the shelves in the CVS and Walgreens, you've got a shortage of just about everything.
Whoa, a shortage of just about everything? No. Look, I just got comfortable with in-person grocery shopping less than 6 months ago. Fully vaccinated and always masked, I've really enjoyed selecting my own produce again. But I am not ready to go back to the madness of American panic shopping we experienced in the spring of 2020.
Well, just a crazy scene at a grocery store where toilet paper has been in high demand.
Yeah, surveillance video shows a stampede of customers clearing the shelves.
Fights over toilet paper breaking out in grocery stores as shelves run empty.
That, as I understand it, was a totally different situation. Again, there is not, maybe I should state the thesis, a statement right here. There is not one supply chain crisis. There are many supply chain crises that, for the purpose of headline writing, we just call a supply chain crisis. So for toilet paper, that was an entirely different situation. For toilet paper, as I understand it, the problem was that toilet paper manufacturers and distributors were used to distributing both to residences and to corporations. But when the corporate demand for toilet paper dried up because no one was going to offices, then that toilet paper supply was not efficiently redirected toward households by sending all of it to the CVSs and Walgreens of the world. So a totally different situation explained the toilet paper crisis, which is distinct from the used car crisis, which is distinct from the semiconductor crisis. There's a bunch of different stuff that's going on. And I do not in any way blame casual listeners or even, frankly, sometimes experts for not understanding exactly every single part of this incredibly complex chain.
There is more than one supply chain and more than one supply chain crisis. Okay, got it. So feeling frustrated and confused about all of this is pretty reasonable given the complexity of the issue and the number of different sectors it's affecting. In fact, the complexity can lead us to wonder if these shortages are real or just a convenient excuse for poor service and high prices. It's a concern expressed by Aaron, a listener who called us from Northern California.
I'm a restaurant owner, and at first it was PPP supplies. Then it was paper products. Now I'm having major issues with certain products like chicken, fish, and especially appetizers from distributors selling pre-made frozen items. Super frustrating. Should be noted that I want to, but I'm having a hard time trusting the suppliers. I feel like I'm over a barrel and they can raise prices and tell me that that is because of supply chain issues.
Okay, Aaron, I totally understand your skepticism. I've been wondering the exact same thing about the substantial increase in the price of used cars. Now, my family's in the market for a reliable but low-cost pre-owned vehicle. But the sticker prices, woo-wee! Now, according to Consumer Reports, the increase in used car prices is not a case of price gouging local dealers. The most recent Consumer Price Index report shows used car prices are up almost a full third over the same time last year. So I asked The Atlantic's Derek Thompson why the price of used cars has jumped so notably. After all, used cars are not sitting in the shipping containers bobbing in the harbor.
The supply chain crisis is not just one thing. It's not like a traffic jam that's been created because there's one accident. It's like a traffic jam where you can see cars being backed up along a highway for 17 miles and you have no idea what exactly is causing it because there might be so many different things that are causing it. So for used cars, let's just take that one very specifically. The issue with used cars and in many cases is that during the pandemic, you had a lot of rental car companies sell off their cars because no one was buying rental cars. And it created, when the economy opened up, a logjam as everyone was trying to buy back used cars, including the Hertzes and Nationals of the world that you're now competing with. So you can't find a used car that previously wouldn't have all this competition from the Hertzes and Nationals trying to stock up on all the cars that they sold off when no one was traveling. That explains the used car situation. But there's a bunch of totally random, extremely specific supply chain crises all over the place that essentially exacerbate what from the media sometimes looks like merely a container problem.
Ha. Buying a used car has gotten more expensive because of one part of the broken supply chain. And as Rob, who called us from New Jersey, has recently learned, another part of the supply chain crisis is making it much slower to repair a car.
It took 2 weeks for my mechanic to get a door switch that he thought would take 2 days. He told us that he was told that there were only 3 available in the country.
Now, these shortages are annoying. But are they truly a crisis? I mean, in other countries, even those with high GDPs, supermarket shelves aren't stocked and stacked in the way that they are in the U.S. And the notion of how much should be available for purchase is just really very different in other places. There is no nation in the world except the U.S. where store shelves groan under the weight of so many products in so many varieties. High-income Americans may be used to choosing any pair of sneaker in any color combination we prefer, clicking add to cart and finding a Zappos box on our front porch within 48 hours. We don't just want breakfast cereal. We want to make a choice between 14 different kinds of cereal. So even as we're defining multiple supply chain crises, I have to wonder if it's even a crisis at all, especially since all of this abundance contributes to plenty of waste, which was the story of the 2017 documentary, Wasted, the Story of Food Waste.
In the United States, 40% of the food we produce is going to waste.
Food production is the single biggest cause of deforestation, water extraction, biodiversity loss.
More and more people are concerned about climate change, and one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases is the food that they're throwing away.
We are literally taking food out of the mouths of the hungry and sending food waste into landfill. That is crazy.
We don't need to produce more. We need to act different.
Despite the dramatic documentary music and convincing statistics of impending global
doom,
Derek Thompson offered a more sober response to my consumption angst.
I have a lot of friends that I would consider of my politics, relatively liberal, who do feel like a lesson of this pandemic is that we should consume less. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. But at the same time, what strikes me is that it'd be much better if we could find efficient and non-climate destroying ways of making enough. I would love us to pursue and think very seriously about an abundance agenda, not a paucity agenda, to find ways to make enough of everything that people need rather than force people to only consume or ask that people only consume just as much as they can get by consuming. So when it comes to something like American cereal, yep, there are a lot of different kinds of American cereal. That's true. But I'm not sure that that's like a moral crisis. I think it's wonderful that there's so many different kinds of cereal that people can choose from. And it's not entirely clear to me that the abundance of American cereal is creating is directly and uniquely responsible for any particular environmental crisis. So I would love us to look at this supply chain crisis and rather than think, oh, you know, maybe we should all live a more sustainable, ascetic, homespun lifestyle that reduces our dependency on goods that activate a global supply chain. Like, sure, you can ask for that, but it's never going to happen. American culture is not going to change in a dime. It would be better if our response to the everything shortage that we're experiencing is to have a policy that makes more of everything that we need. So for example, it seems very clear to me that we need more containers, which carry more than 90% of the world's traded goods. Let's make more containers if that's the crisis. We probably need more semiconductors for cars. You seem to be dealing very specifically with a used car situation, which would be ameliorated by the manufacturing of more cars, not only for people in America, but around the world. Okay, let's think of ways to build more semiconductors so that everyone who wants to drive can drive a hopefully efficient car that doesn't, you know, emit a lot of gas and hopefully is either a hybrid or electric vehicle. Sorry to rant a little bit in response to this question. It's just something that I've thought about a lot that rather, I think, than seek a shortage policy, I want us to seek an abundance policy and do so in a responsible way.
So Derek's invocation of an abundance policy, despite our current experiences of shortage, is provocative and maybe a bit counterintuitive. I wondered if there is any historic precedent for the supply chain issues we're facing. Perhaps if we face this trouble before, our history might also give us a roadmap for getting out. But Derek does not see clear mirrors in a prior era.
You know, there's lots of ways in which a variety of economic indicators that we're seeing today are mildly reminiscent of the 1970s. And I don't want to draw this analogy too tightly because the 1970s will conjure images of stagflation and gas lines, and we don't have stagnation. The economy is growing, and we don't have gas lines. That said, we have a couple other things. We have a shortage, and the oil crisis was in many ways a natural resource shortage. We have a little bit of inflation. We'll see how much that inflation sticks around. We have more business dynamism. We have more people starting companies than they have in any decade since the 1970s and 1960s. We also have wages rising for low-income Americans at a very rare pace for the 21st century. Wages are rising for low-income Americans in a way that actually looks much more like the middle slash end of the 20th century. So I would say that in a variety of ways, both good and bad, we are seeing little tendrils of the 1970s economy perking up in 2021.
All right. So how about the question on everyone's mind heading into the holidays? Will there be toys on the shelves in December?
There will be toys on the shelves in December. They just might not be the toy that you want or your child wants. So my advice to parents, I know, I'm sorry to say something so terrifying and so Halloween-ish. But speaking of Christmas in October, for years, we've complained about Christmas creep, the idea that Christmas decorations enter stores in late November, early November, late October. Well, this year, I think we should practice Christmas creep as a shopping strategy. We should think very, very early about what our kids and loved ones want and try very hard to buy it for them as soon as possible. Because I absolutely do believe that while the supply chain crisis, for a variety of reasons, is not going to necessarily last for another 6 months, another 9 months, it's definitely, I think, going to last another 2 months. And for that reason, I think that we should be very diligent about making those Christmas lists a little bit earlier this year.
Even as Derek counseled Y shoppers to begin purchasing holiday gifts as soon as possible, many of you called to tell us that you're avoiding supply chain issues by reducing or foregoing gifts altogether.
Hi, this is Rebecca from Fife, Washington. And between the supply chain issues and how our overconsumption is affecting climate change, my family has been discussing doing activities or maybe a trip as gifts this year instead of buying more stuff. So, for example, doing a glass blowing class or going for a snowboarding trip instead of more things.
I've been thinking a lot about our shopping during this upcoming holiday season and have decided to double down on our family's focus on meaningful gift giving, purchasing from locally owned businesses, from artists and crafters on Etsy, gifting more experiences than things, and just buying less. We hope the supply chain problems will be a non-issue for us, while at the same time still creating some holiday magic. This is Lisa from San Jose, California.
I so appreciate everybody who called with these terrific suggestions. And while options like planning early or reducing consumption are good ways for individuals and households to avoid some of the worst problems of the supply chain, the possibility of a lean Christmas has meaningful consequences for the economy. And of course, ruining Christmas is never good politics. Republican lawmakers and conservative columnists want to hear from top officials in the Biden administration, and they've increased calls to compel congressional testimony from Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, and Pete Buttigieg, Secretary of Transportation. In a particularly scathing piece for The Hill, columnist Joe Concha argues that media have spilled more ink about Buttigieg's newborn twins than about his responsibilities as Secretary of Transportation to address the shipping container crisis. And the troubling politics of a Christmastime supply chain crisis undoubtedly prompted President Biden to address the nation late last week. The president focused on a series of public-private partnerships that will ramp up national freight services to a 24-hour operation.
With the holidays coming up, you might be wondering if gifts you plan to buy will arrive on time. Today, we have some good news. They're going to help speed up the delivery of goods all across America. The Port of Los Angeles announced today that it's going to begin operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This follows the Port of Long Beach's commitment to 24/7 that it announced just weeks ago. This is the first key step toward moving our entire freight, transportation, and logistical supply chain nationwide to a 24/7 system.
Executing this 24-hour strategy may prove challenging given the unprecedented labor market. something that Derek Thompson addressed in our conversation.
You see not only more Americans quitting than any time on record, 3% of Americans quit last month, 7% of restaurant and hotel workers quit just last month. That's one out of 14 people working in a hotel, restaurant, or bar. You definitely are seeing an enormous amount of churn in the labor market. And churn tends to be really good for wage growth. I mean, if you are in a labor market where everyone is terrified of quitting their job because they have no idea if they can find work outside of wherever they happen to be employed, well, then your boss doesn't need to give you a raise, does he or does she? He or she can just say, you're going to stick around. I'm not going to give you a raise ever because you're basically stuck here. Well, people are definitely not stuck anywhere. They can quit and find job openings in many different sectors of the economy. And that's why I think you particularly see labor churn in places like restaurants and hotels. I mean, if you're working for, you know, a small restaurant in North Carolina that's paying you, I don't know, $11 an hour. I don't happen to know what the minimum wage is in North Carolina, but they're paying you $11 an hour. You walk down the street, you see the McDonald's is going to pay you $15 or $20 an hour. Why wouldn't you quit? You'd be crazy not to quit. Of course you should quit and get that job that's going to pay you, you know, 30% more, 40% more. So this is what's happening. And of course, it is good for workers overall. It is difficult for bosses and employers. I'm not one of these people who has absolutely no sympathy for bosses and employers. You know, running companies is a really important part of keeping the American economy going. And they are suddenly having to deal with all sorts of changes of worker expectations in this new normal. But raising wages is a good thing for just about everyone.
Thank you so much for joining us, not only to understand some of these core aspects of what's happening in this moment, but to think some big thoughts about our economy. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Jody Pinion from Charleston, South Carolina. I have definitely started my holiday shopping already. I do most of my shopping online, and I'm very concerned about getting everything I want from my family on time. I'm even worried that some of the items won't be available at all.
This is Janie calling from Vashon Island, Washington. Our family chose to stop doing Christmas many years ago. Our two sons suggested that we no longer be part of the consumer realm and that we begin to create our own celebrations. And so we have. Now we gather to celebrate the changing of the seasons, the coming of light, and to share our gratitude for one another.
Hi, my name is Keith. I'm calling from San Francisco, California. I buy presents all year long for people. When I see something that I think they'll like, I get it, and I set it aside, and sometimes I forget, so some people get lots of presents. But I have a reputation to maintain as a good present giver and the best gay gunkle that they have.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Pavlika from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm the worst holiday shopper and always wait for the last minute. This year, I'm not taking any chances with empty shelves or supply chain issues. My holiday shopping's almost done.
I've been thinking a lot about our shopping during this upcoming holiday season and have decided to double down on our family's focus on meaningful gift giving, purchasing from locally owned businesses, from artists and crafters on Etsy, gifting more experiences than things, and just buying less. We hope the supply chain problems will be a non-issue for us, while at the same time still creating some holiday magic. This is Lisa from San Jose, California.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic.
Llámanos al 877-869-8253.
Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
The supply chain crisis has plenty of holiday shoppers starting early this year. Even though it's not yet Halloween, it's already Christmas stocking stuffer time. Now, if kids are on your holiday list, you might notice that things are looking a little less pink and blue these days. In recent years, some parents and advocates have pushed to break the binary when it comes to our kids' toys. Last week, Lego, the world's largest toy maker, announced it would make its toys more gender neutral. And earlier this month, the state of California passed a law requiring large retailers to display toys and childcare items in gender-neutral ways. I spoke with Elizabeth Sweet, assistant professor of sociology at San Jose State University, and I started by asking whether she's surprised by Lego's recent decision.
It is a little surprising in that even just 5 years ago, the toy industry was really resistant to making these kinds of changes. They were really interested more in broadening the categories for boys and for girls rather than deconstructing them. So it is a little surprising to see them make this commitment. But on the other hand, I think it's not surprising in that if we look at where society is and the conversations we're having about gender, you know, I think the toy industry is really playing catch up and recognizing that it's not really profitable anymore to rely so heavily on gender stereotyping. So it's a kind of a yes and no.
Let's talk about gender stereotyping in toys, because this goes to the heart of your research. And I think it's one of those things that we think of as always true, right? Just always true that there were girls' toys and boys' toys. But you actually show that there's change over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my research, I examined toy catalogs from the 20th century to try to understand how toys have been marketed historically, particularly in regards to gender, but also in regards to race. And so what I found in this research is that historically, toys were a lot less gendered than they were in the 21st century. And also that there was a lot of variation over time in the extent of gender marketing and in the ways in which gender coding was accomplished. But as we see today, those historic shifts in gender marketing were really connected to larger shifts that were happening in society in terms of cultural beliefs about gender and in the structures of gender inequality in the adult world. So I think, you know, now we're in a moment where there's a lot of contestation around gender. So it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing this play out in the world of children's toys, but people tend to think this is something that's always been this way. And that's just really not the case. Historically, toys were much less likely to be gendered than they are today.
As a parent, my eldest is nearly 20 now. And I got to say, over those two decades, you know, like one of the phrases I've picked up is, you know, before you're a parent, you're a sociologist and you think that it's all about how children are reared. And after you have children, you're a geneticist and you're like, nope, they just showed up like this. This one may be much less in my control than I think. So help me to understand what's at stake here. I mean, I just will say, my nephew is going to pick up anything and turn it into a sword, even if you never give him a sword to play with.
It's really hard to tease out the effects of any one thing on kids when kids are born into a world where everything is gender coded. You know, gender categorization is one of the most primary categorizations that we make as humans. And, you know, all of these categorizations carry this heavy set of cultural beliefs and stereotypes around them. So, you know, by the time kids are three or four, they have been exposed. They've, you know, been swimming in this sea of gender stereotypes. So when we look at a child and see them kind of responding to these stereotypes, perhaps it's not surprising. But there's a lot of really excellent work in the field of developmental psychology that finds that kids' preferences and interests really are shaped by these products. And if you label something for boys or for girls, it affects how kids feel about it and whether they think it's appropriate for them. Is it surprising that girls tend to prefer pink when everything, all of their products are pink? If you give people one choice, they're going to choose that, right? So, but I think what we find is that if you give kids a much broader selection of choice. And if there aren't heavy social costs and potential social benefits for choosing particular choices, then kids are much more likely to, you're much more likely to see the diversity of interests that kids have.
I've also noticed there is, and maybe this is, as you just pointed out, the issue of social costs, that gender fluidity and gender neutrality across toys and play interests seems to be sufficiently well, or maybe not sufficiently, but it is rewarded or at least not punished for girls who make gender neutral or what we would think of as gender fluid choices into preferences we tend to think of as male. So, you know, my 7-year-old really liking Blaze and the Monster Machines, everybody's down for that. No problem. Blaze and the Monster Machines for the 7-year-old girl. But the gender fluidity from male to female, the idea of my nephew wanting to carry around a baby doll, oh, that gets policed and people will take the doll out of his hand.
The line between sort of girls' toys and everything else has always been much sharper than the line between boys' toys and gender neutral. In fact, historically, like boys' toys and gender neutral were really hard to distinguish sometimes, you know, in terms of color schemes and things like that. But I do think that boys are sanctioned much more heavily for transgressing those gender norms. And that's a really big thing to worry about because, you know, the toys that promote social skills, that promote empathy and caring, those are marketed almost exclusively to girls. And yet, you know, boys go on to parent. They, you know, compassion and care are just human characteristics that are beneficial to our society. So relegating those characteristics only to girls is problematic. And, you know, in the same way, I think toy lines that have tried to expand femininity, you know, making STEM toys pink for girls, that's problematic too, because again, it suggests that girls are fundamentally different and incapable of just doing science. Science is not gendered. So why do we have to gender it to appeal to girls?
What moves corporations to make these kinds of decisions? Is it legislative action, like the recent bill in California, or is it marketing pressure from parents and caregivers who are purchasing the toys?
That's a great question. I mean, I think some of the changes like we're seeing from Lego or Mattel has made some similar changes within the past couple of years. Those are really about money, right? They understand that the parents of today have a lot more progressive attitudes about gender than parents of, you know, 10 years ago, perhaps. So they recognize that this is going to be profitable for them. But it shouldn't be left to the goodness of a company's heart, you know, or whether it's profitable for them to make sure that our products are good for our kids. So in that way, I think the legislation is incredibly important. And the legislation in California is really aimed at, you know, at the retail side. So making sure that that there is an option for a gender neutral toy aisle, even if the rest of the toy aisles are kind of pink and blue. But the toys themselves are still very heavily gendered. So we need to address both the way that toys are sold, but also the way that toys are made and marketed.
Elizabeth Sweet is an assistant professor of sociology at San Jose State University. Professor Sweet, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
A boy of peculiar grace, manhood lost and not found till now.
You're listening to the voice of baritone Will Liverman, singing Peculiar Grace from the opera Fire Shut Up in My Bones. It's the second opera from Terrence Blanchard, a 6-time Grammy winner, jazz trumpeter, and composer of over 40 scores. Now, Blanchard's body of work earned him a BAFTA and an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Score for Spike Lee's 2018 film, Black Klansman. And while it is Blanchard's second opera, it is his first, and the first by a Black composer and an entirely Black cast, to play at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. Fire Shut Up in My Bones is based on a memoir of the same title written by New York Times columnist Charles Blow. Now, Blanchard and librettist Casey Lemons authored the music and lyrics, bringing to life Blow's story of growing up in rural Louisiana, surviving sexual abuse, and navigating the restrictions of narrowly defined masculinity. I sat down with Terrence Blanchard to talk about his many accomplishments and his musical journey. And here's what he told me about his personal experience watching the opera at the Met.
It's a bit of a surreal experience, you know, because part of me is still in disbelief that this is even happening. But then the other part of me is like extremely proud of all of the efforts of everyone who's involved in the production, because those are some amazing singers, some of the most brilliant voices that I've heard ever. And I don't know how to describe my feeling of being able to create something that allows them to display all of their talents, you know, and to see Camille create movement in a ballet that's just like very unique and beautiful is an incredible thing. And it all starts with Casey Lemons' words, you know, the libretto. She wrote a beautiful libretto that's very poetic, but still very powerful.
Indeed, let's go to one aspect of that, and that is peculiar grace. For you, what do you hear in those words? I kept reflecting on them over and over again, every time they came back, every time we had to encounter them again, this idea of being a boy with peculiar grace.
Well, you know, the first thing that always pops in my mind is the idea of the isolationist kind of existence in a community that you really want to belong to, you know. I experienced that growing up in New Orleans. You know, even though New Orleans is a music town, my neighborhood wasn't one that thought it was very cool to walk to the bus stop with a horn in your hand on the weekends going to my lessons, you know. Or, you know, while I was sitting at the piano in the big bay window in the front of my house practicing my lesson, it wasn't the coolest thing for my boys to see me do that, you know. And wanting to still belong to that community, it hurts, you know, when people kind of treat you differently because you are a little different, you know. But the thing about it is there's a burning desire within you that you don't really get yet because you can be too young to understand it. And with Charles, you know, I thought his success where he is in his life right now is a true testament to how resilient he's been and how strong he's been to not only withstand that, but withstand the pain of being molested by a family member. And to me, you know, his existence is evidence of how anyone who's struggling with this can overcome it. You know, you can overcome anything, you know, if you put your mind and heart and soul into it. And that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to do this story.
I knew that I was going to be coming to see the performance on a Friday night. And I think it was maybe on Tuesday or Wednesday night of that week, I was having dinner with some friends and saying, you know, I'm almost reluctant to go because I don't think I can cope with, and the language I used was molestation set to music. Luckily, many of the people who were at this dinner had actually seen the performance and immediately jumped to explain not how it was staged, but to ease my mind that I would be able, even as a survivor, to sit through that. But can you talk to me a bit about that process of making sure that that moment wasn't molestation set to music?
The first thought was we didn't want to traumatize the actors, you know. We have, you know, a young boy who's 13 years old, who's doing a brilliant job. And we didn't want to put him through any of that. And then obviously we wanted to make sure that the story wasn't totally about that. It was about overcoming that, you know. And when I talked to Jim Robinson, who directed it in St. Louis when we first did it, you know, that was a concern of mine. And he said, don't worry, we're going to make sure that they don't even touch. You know, so that's why we put them on opposite sides of the bed, you know, and we just let, you know, everything kind of unfold through the dialogue. And we don't even get graphic in the dialogue, as you know, but it is a clear indication of what went down. I think the aftermath of the event is more violent than the actual act itself. You know, it's when he says, you know, come on, let's play the game again. And he says, no, I don't want to. That has a little more aggression in it than the actual molestation itself.
That 13-year-old boy, his voice, I still don't even know what to do with it. His talent was, his talent was as big as the Met itself.
Oh yeah, Walter Russell III. You know, he is an amazing kid, man. You know, and he's a kid. You know, and I love that about him. He's brilliant. And during the rehearsals, it was amazing to watch him be brilliant in rehearsals. And then as soon as we took a break, you know, he's making paper airplanes and running around playing with other kids, you know. And I love it because his parents are like really great people. They understand what he's going through. They're allowing him still to be a kid. They're not helicopter parents or anything like that. They're normal people, which results in him being a normal kid, you know. And his talent is boundless, man, you know. And I was talking about him the other day, and I told him, I said, you know, if you keep working at this, you know, possibly one day the Met could be putting on one of your productions. I really firmly believe that because he has that type of talent.
And yet you are the first African-American composer to have your opera, and this is not your first opera, but it is the first opera at the Met for an African-American composer. Do you understand this as a Black opera?
No, we don't look at it that way. And the reason for that is because we never even talked about it. You know, it was in the aftermath of the first of the premiere that we realized that the cast was all Black. You know, that it wasn't something we set out to do. We just set out to really just tell Charles's story, you know, and we felt like it was a universal story that a lot of people could relate to. Now, it just so happens that as we've done that, the entire cast is a Black cast. And I'm very proud of that fact, you know, because as you can see, it's a cast filled with amazing talent. And it's not just on stage. You know, when you look at Camille Brown, who's the choreographer and co-director, she's a genius and she's amazing. And like I said earlier, Casey Lemons, you know, her words are just powerful and very poetic.
There was one moment that was definitely the most subversive Black people in the Met moment that I couldn't have even fathomed it until it happened. Yes. And it's the step show. So like, as it happens, I'm thinking, oh, this is really happening. This is a full on probate at the Met. And then the audience went absolutely berserk, just on their feet to the rafters. And I'm looking over, I saw you and you're looking up at the rafters and I'm like, this is incredible. There's a step show at the Met.
No, I love that moment, you know, in the opera. When we first did it in St. Louis, man, I just always have to make this mention because, you know, there was talk of trying to cut the opera down. And one of the first things that some people wanted to cut was the step show. And I said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is a huge part of our culture. This is a huge part of what people need to experience, you know, and it's a huge part of college life, you know, and HBCUs. So how can you tell Charles's story without having this be a part of it? And man, I was making fun of the dancers. I was telling them, you know, from the dress rehearsal, even at the premiere, I'm like, you dudes get applause just walking on the stage. <You know? laughs> I said, I've never seen that before, man. I mean, you just walk on the stage and people go nuts, you know? So it's been a beautiful thing because that is one of the things that has resonated with a lot of people from the African-American community because they're seeing themselves on the stage. Nobody thought they would ever see that. And I got to tell you this, Melissa, the interesting thing about this production is that everybody in the production understands what this means. The very first day of rehearsal, after we did Camille's movement exercises, we sat down in a circle and we just talked. We talked, the entire cast, we talked about the meaningfulness of putting this on, the meaningfulness of it being at the Met and, you know, their purpose for being there. And it was one of the most beautiful moments I've ever experienced in anything that I've done, to see people in tears, to see people excited about having their family members to come and see this.
I can absolutely, I could see that not only in the players, but in your, in the conductor, and how the conductor was also received, again, yes, by the entire audience.
Yes, yes. Well, Yannick is an amazing person, you know, let alone an amazing conductor. It's so, I don't even know how to describe him. I get such a warm feeling around him because he is one of the people who's been pushing for this. You know, he's been saying, you know, I love Verdi, I love Puccini, I love Wagner. He says, but we have to do stories that relate to people's lives today if we want opera to survive. And, you know, I remember when he said that, I told him, I said, listen, when we did my opera Champion in New Orleans, there was a gentleman who was in his 70s who walked up to me and he said, this African-American gentleman, he said, hey man, if this is opera, I'll come. That statement stuck with me and it made me realize, right, opera initially was music for the masses. We have to get back to that. We have to stop this elitist thing where we want people to come to the arts. You know, no, the arts has to go to the people. We have to reach out and be relevant.
Talk a little bit about Champion. That's your first opera, mm-hmm. and it is about the life of a closeted gay boxer, Emile Griffith. Talk to me about the decision to do that story as opera.
Well, you know, initially when they first commissioned me to write an opera, they wanted me to do an opera about Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And I had, at the time, I felt like it was too close. I didn't want to deal with that topic. You know, I said, maybe later, but not right now. And I've always been a big boxing fan. And my best friend, who's also was a professional fighter, his name is Michael Bent. He told me about the story of Emile's life and told me about the book 9, 10 and Out. Which is his biography. And one of the things in the book that Emile said that just blew me away, he said, you know, well, let me back up. You know, he fought a guy named Benny Perrette 3 times. The first 2 times they each won the fight, right? So the third time was gonna be the deciding bout. And Benny Perrette, you know, wanted to get an edge on Emile. So at that time, you know, if you knew about somebody's sexuality, that wasn't something that you just talked about in public. People kept that to themselves. So during the press conference, he was trying to get inside of Emile's head, and he used a very derogatory term for a gay male at the press conference. And Emile was upset. He says, why is he saying these things? So come to the fight. They get into the fight. Emile hits him 17 times within 7 seconds. I forgot what round it was. Benny was knocked out, fell into a coma for 10 days and died, you know, and it was a really devastating thing for Emile because they were friends. So in his book, one of the things that he said that struck me and it really hit me really hard, he said, I killed a man and the world forgave me. He said, but I love the man and the world will never forgive me. That was the reason why I wanted to do the book, because I kept thinking about the first time I won an award. You know, I turned to my wife, gave her a kiss without thinking, and just went up to the stage and grabbed my award. And I thought about it, he couldn't do that. He couldn't share his championship belt with someone he loved openly. And that, to me, is a shame.
And it has a particular kind of, not just shame, but the tragedy that I think, in the broadest sense, the most maybe classical sense of tragic. And I wonder if you could just reflect for a moment, because you are a connoisseur of many different forms of musical art, a true New Orleanian in that way. What is it that distinguishes opera for you? What are the stories that you are drawn to most specifically in an operatic form?
Well, I mean, a lot of times with opera, man, it's all about tragedy, you know, but it's also about love. You know, La Boheme is one of my favorite operas, you know, and it's all about the pain, the joy, and the suffering of being in love and trying to navigate those waters, you know. So it's one of the reasons why I started to come back to opera. I wasn't really an opera fan for a long time because my father, growing up, he loved opera and would play his opera records around the house, you know. And when he would do that, Melissa, you'd hit door slamming in the house because people would be like, oh, man, there he goes. You know, years later, man, it started to resonate in my soul. You know, when I would hear these recordings, I said, you know what? Just as a composer, I need to just really listen to this stuff a little more in-depthly. You know, and when I started to do that, you know, I started to develop a real passion for it. Then all of a sudden, Opera Theater St. Louis calls me to write an opera, and they brought me to their season, which was the first time that I actually saw opera live on a stage. And then I was just totally hooked.
Is there another project directly on the horizon that we can look forward to?
Well, you know, at the gala, the night of the premiere, after the performance, Yannick, the conductor, announced that the Met is going to commission me to write another opera, you know. And, you know, it was so funny because hearing it, you know, you have mixed emotions. You go, man, that's great. Then the other part of you is like, yeah, but can I get a nap first? Because it's just a lot of work, man. You know, writing it for 2 years and then you workshop it. And then when we got here, we were in rehearsal for about 5 to 6 weeks.
I'm just putting out there, I want a woman's story next time. I want to see what Terrence Blanchard does with a Black woman's story. There are so many untold ones, but I would, I take any from you. That's my request.
You know, I'm going to tell my boss that one, and she'll probably do the research.
I know she will. Actually, let me text the right person to put that request in for.
Exactly.
Terrence Blanchard, award-winning musician, composer across genres. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, man, thank you for having me. It was great seeing you, and it's great talking to you.
Okay, folks, that's all we have for you today. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Now, before we go, we've got some good news for you. During the last 5 months, I've had the chance to work with an absolutely incredible, ever-evolving team of producers as interim host of The Takeaway. We've talked about backyard chickens and Broadway shows. We've discussed crises in Afghanistan, Haiti, and Ethiopia. We've chatted with lawmakers, educators, authors, and reporters, and most importantly, we've continued our ongoing conversation with you, the listeners and community of The Takeaway, which is something this show has been doing for nearly 14 years. Now, periodically, we take new directions and we welcome new hosts, but what has always remained is the core relationship between this show and your lives. Which is why I am thrilled and honored to announce I'll be staying on as the permanent host and managing editor of The Takeaway. Creating The Takeaway each day is an extraordinary privilege, and we promise that you will remain at the center of every conversation we have. I am so excited for this new adventure, and we hope you feel the same. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm the new host of The Takeaway. Yay! Come on back tomorrow for more.